Thank you, Harry, for that generous invitation. The check, of course, will be in the mail. First, I would like to express my appreciation to the members of the Philadelphia Society for the opportunity to reconsider the welfare state and its consequences with special reference to the Lochner case and Buck versus Bell. Just a word about my background, just so that we are all on the same level playing field. I should point out that I came from a family that was so weird, so strange, they took the fun out of being merely dysfunctional. Let's begin. It is clear that the New Deal initiated the most important period of constitutional change since the Civil War. Equally clear, the events that sparked the New Deal were echoed most recently by the economic and financial collapse of 2008, which triggered President Obama's current efforts to save American capitalism. In this regard, three things are noticeable. First, President Obama's recovery plans will leave the government permanently bigger, more costly, and more intrusive. Second, his approach recalls the efforts of his predecessor and model, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And third, his devotion to the rule of law means deciding first what he wants to do and then looking for a way to bend the law to permit it. Given these developments, it's an appropriate time to reconsider the constitutional implications arising out of the New Deal and the Progressive Era. Before elaborating, I offer four caveats. First, defining welfare state constitutionalism is somewhat problematic. Endorsing a robust role for government as protector and provider, progressive constitutionalism signaled the death of Lochnerian jurisprudence, the demise of natural rights, and the collapse of the doctrine of liberty of contract. Second, progressive constitutionalism is characterized by an expansive conception of state and federal police power and a broad interpretation of the Commerce Clause. Third, an extensive examination of the New Deal indicates that progressive constitutional change has inflicted adverse consequences on the nation and on members of disadvantaged groups. Fourth, the growth in the size of government during the New Deal underscores the tendency of governments to exploit periods of crisis in order to expand their powers beyond what is required to resolve the crisis at hand. Constitutional change during periods of crisis provides an opportunity to redistribute power and wealth to big business, big labor, and big lobbyists. With these caveats in mind, I shall argue that the chief weakness of welfare state constitutionalism is that it set the stage for a rapidly growing state and a reduction in human liberty. Before proceeding, let me say a few words about Lochner and liberty of contract. First, the post-Civil War doctrine of liberty of contract held that any law that was unrelated to a legitimate end was void. Second, there is doubt that the Lochner decision squares with anything approaching an originalist understanding of the Due Process Clause contained within either the Fifth or the 14th Amendment. Third, judicial support for liberty of contract during the Lochner era was actually quite limited. Lochner held that a state law designed to regulate bakers' hours in order to advance workers' bargaining power was impermissible because it lacked a legitimate purpose. As such, the law interfered with the right of contract between employer and employee. On the other hand, the Lochner court conceded that if the contested statute had been designed to regulate bakers' hours in order to protect their health, then the law would have a legitimate purpose consistent with the state's police power. Consistent with this paternalistic view, which allows a fair and reasonable use of state police power, the doctrine of liberty of contract was only sporadically invoked. Returning to the topic of progressive constitutionalism, the question becomes, how did we reach a point in our history wherein the size and scope of government reflects the fact that the state has permeated civil society to such an extent that the two are mostly indistinguishable? A number of answers surface, including the fact that progressives during the Progressive Era and continuing through the New Deal were convinced that society was a living organism that must obey the law of life rather than mechanics. Exchanging the pursuit of the true for the pursuit of the good, progressives believe that the Constitution must be interpreted pursuant to evolving Darwinian principles, thus ensuring that the state remained a suitable instrument for controlling the nation's health. Influenced by pseudo-evolutionary values, progressives believe that government was entitled to impose a form of jurisprudence that bears a striking resemblance to social Darwinism. Combining paternalism with a dangerous faith in the benevolence of the state, President Roosevelt's brash insistence on increasing the price of labor during the Great Depression increased unemployment and human suffering and widened the unemployment gap between blacks and whites. Pursuing human perfectibility and reflecting the notion that the Constitution was a living instrument, reformers were in fact simultaneously conservative and liberal. Their liberal instincts drove them to pursue social justice in order to uplift the poor and disenfranchised. Their conservative instincts led them to call for social control as a vehicle to eliminate the causes of economic and social disorder. As elitists, progressives believe that intellectuals should guide social and economic progress, a faith erected upon two complementary convictions, a belief in the disinterestedness and incorruptibility of the experts who would run the welfare state, and a belief that expertise could not only serve the social good, but also identify it. The tension between progressives' conservative and liberal instincts was ultimately resolved by appealing to hereditary fitness as a scientific basis for distinguishing workers worthy of uplift from workers who should be regarded as threats to the health and well-being of society. This move unleashed a war on the weak. Within the labor arena, progressive theorists judged an impressive array of humans to be unworthy of work. Who were the unemployables? Simply put, unemployables were workers who, because of their alleged hereditary debility, earned less than what American reformers called a living wage. Hence, employers that paid and workers who accepted less than a living wage were called parasites. The term parasites was applied to Chinese immigrants, Jews, and African Americans on grounds that they were racially disposed to work for lower wages and thus displaced native workers. Striving to remove such threats, early progressives accepted solutions offered by Fabian socialists such as Sidney and Beatrice Webb. Specific solutions included eugenics, minimum wage legislation, support for labor unions or other employee protective legislation, which, if enacted, would engender job losses for undeserving workers and thus restore the nation's health. Echoing South African labor history, these exclusionary moves were extended to women, children, immigrants, and minorities by influential labor reformers. Many reformers endorsed the minimum wage in order to prevent unbridled competition. Reflecting the power of this idea, the minimum wage provisions associated with the National Industrial Recovery Act caused 500,000 blacks to lose their jobs before the Supreme Court invalidated this law shortly after its passage. Federal innovation was, of course, preceded by state efforts to eradicate the inefficient from both the nation and the labor force. In Mueller versus Oregon, which was decided 3 years after Lochner, the Supreme Court accepted substantial documentation which allegedly showed that the physical structure of females justified state restrictions on the hours that women could work. Such documentation enabled the court to find a legitimate purpose, thus justifying the regulation of work hours for women. Almost two decades later, and after sustaining statutes that limited the work hours of men in certain industries, the Supreme Court examined the idea that human perfection could be purchased by genetic purification. Posited as a stubborn necessity and embraced as a compelling faith, proponents of exclusion believe that purification required collective action. Surrendering to the growing demand for collective action in Buck versus Bell, Justice Holmes, writing for the court, upheld the right of the state of Virginia to remove the reproductive capacity of custodial inmates on grounds that unwanted characteristics were spread through genetic exchange. Dismissing due process of law and equal protection challenges, the court agreed that sterilization was justified by the laws of heredity and by the allegation that Ms. Buck was the probable potential parent of socially inadequate offspring. Based on this highly documented and highly suspect claim, the state of Virginia was permitted to deploy its police power in order to advance the nation's health. Believing that social progress is a higher law than equality, and equating good government with active government, the court accepted expert opinion and held that three generations of Bucks were enough. In the moments that remain, let's consider two cases decided in 1937, West Coast Hotel versus Parrish, and NLRB versus Jones and Laughlin. Reacting swiftly to the outcry caused by its Tapaldo decision, the Parrish Court completely abandoned the doctrine of substantive due process and liberty of contract. No longer would courts invalidate state police power on grounds that the law at issue exceeded the boundaries of natural law embedded in the social contract, No longer would courts require extensive documentation as a predicate to approval. Instead, the court determined that the law at issue was adopted in the interest of the community, and hence minimum wage regulation complied with due process of law. Overruling Adkins, which had previously struck down a similar law, the parish court upheld the state of Washington's minimum wage law for women, thus signifying that the 14th Amendment could no longer prevent the state from responding to modern conditions, even though a particular law might previously have been dismissed as oppressive. Matching this move, which broadened state police power, the court in Jones and Laughlin accepted a broad interpretation of the Commerce Clause. Although the NLRA, like its predecessor, the National Industrial Recovery Act, served to massively exclude minorities from the workplace, the court decided that Congress had the power to regulate labor practices, including intrastate practices that affected commerce. As the court increasingly made clear, neither substantive due process within the meaning of the Fifth Amendment nor the doctrine of liberty of contract could prevent federal interference with economic freedom. These cases reified Justice Holmes's ambitious opinion in Buck, which was actually premised on his dissent in Lochner. In Lochner, Holmes stated, "I think the word liberty in the 14th Amendment is perverted when it is held to prevent the natural outcome of dominant opinion." Consistent with this intuition, the Supreme Court in Parrish, fortified by its opinion in Jones and Laughlin, signaled that the progressive legal revolution, grounded in majoritarian paternalism led by experts, was absolute. This meant that the war on the weak could now resume. Taken together, progressive constitutionalism implies that Nietzsche was mostly right, meaning that American democracy increasingly operates within a political culture that sanctions a will to domination. Thank you.